Welcome, everyone, to today's Clue and Internet Seminar on OSC Readiness Presents Constitutional Issues and the OSC, which has been sponsored by the US EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be coming to you from the same office of EPA, helping to moderate today's session. Just a couple of reminders before we officially kick things off, and I turn things over to our speaker today. But if you haven't participated in a Clue and Internet Seminar before, Clue and Seminars are very similar to conference call style events. So each individual participant is expected to have a copy of the presentation materials, open it in front of them, and manually move through the materials at verbal cues from our instructors. If you don't already have a copy of the materials in front of you, I ask you to refer to either your confirmation email or reminder email that you would have received from me, and follow the links within that email or refer back to the seminar homepage, which is the page that has a complete description of today's events, contact info for myself, bios for our instructor, and also head buttons so you can either click Go to Seminar to look at the slides online in a web browser or follow the links at the bottom of that page to download them as PowerPoint or PDF. So hopefully everybody has a copy of the materials open in front of them, and I'm going to ask everyone to move on from slide number one to slide number two, and we're going to cover some basic instructions and reminders. For those of you that are listening by phone, we would ask that you keep your phone lines muted. You can use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your line now. Our instructor will be taking questions and comments throughout his presentation, so at any point if you do have a question or comment, or he asks for your response, you are welcome to unmute by using your own mute button or hitting *6 to unmute your line. But again, until then, while he's giving his presentation, we will ask that everyone remain muted. Also, don't put the call on hold because there could be background music or commercials that will be disruptive. If you need to, you can simply hang up on the line and dial back in without disrupting us. Again, questions and answers will come in at any point. For those of you on the phones, you can take yourself off of mute to ask those questions or make a comment. For those of you who are streaming the audio online, however, you actually can't talk to us. Instead, you have a series of controls that are located along the top of your slides. Again, those of you who are looking at the slides through a web browser window will see a series of numbered links that appear on the left side. And you can use those links to manually move through the slide materials and verbal cues from our instructor. You can also use the arrow buttons. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. There's also a button that has a large question mark icon on top of your slides. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click the question mark button, a new window will open up, and you can actually type up a comment or question. So if you're streaming the audio and you'd like to respond, if you have a question or comment, again, you want to be sure to disable pop-up blockers and click that question mark icon, and then I'll read off your question out loud to our instructor so that he can answer them. You can also use that same icon to report any technical difficulties that you might have with today's session. Just be sure to include a phone number where we can reach you so our support staff can troubleshoot whatever the problem might be. With that, I want to remind everybody that today's session is going to be recorded, and you'll automatically get an email from me in approximately 1 to 2 weeks with the link to download or replay this session for free. And you're welcome to certainly forward that on to any colleagues that you think will find it of interest. And until then, you can also browse the Kluwen archives, where we have almost 400 different recorded sessions throughout Kluwen's history, again, available for free download and replay. Excuse me. So with that, those are the end of the official reminders I have. And again, I just wanted to welcome everyone to today's session on constitutional issues and the OSD. Again, today's session will focus on providing participants with an overview and basic understanding of the U.S. Constitution and those laws that have a direct effect on the OSD. Participants will gain information on such topics as taking, due process, liability, and just compensation. Our instructor is Cliff Villas, who is the Assistant Regional Attorney in EPA Region 10, where he's currently the Acting Manager for Superfund Attorneys in the EPA Region 10 Office of Regional Counsel. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3 to begin the official start of the presentation materials for today's session. And Cliff, whenever you're ready to begin, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Jean, and welcome everyone. Good morning from the West Coast in Seattle, and good afternoon to everyone, Midwest and beyond. I am Cliff Fee, Assistant Regional Counsel with US EPA Region 10 in Seattle, Washington. I'm also an adjunct professor at Seattle University School of Law, and I've also had a recurring role in as an instructor for OSC readiness training, the annual training that EPA puts on. And if you have been to OSC readiness training the last several years, You may have heard some pieces of this presentation in the past that focused more on the Fourth Amendment, but I'm delighted today to have the opportunity to address broader issues of the Constitution more than just the Fourth Amendment, although that is particularly implicated in the work that every OSC does. So thank you all for tuning in, and I think we can probably click on to the next slide, number 4. Before I go any further, as a lawyer, I need to offer the following disclaimers. One, this presentation, it really reflects my own views. I hope they are informed, but they are not necessarily official positions of EPA or the United States. This presentation is not officially cleared by the agency, although I have discussed it with learned people within the agency. Two, while I teach environmental law and I have practiced it for many years, I do not claim to be the expert on the Constitution or any particular field here, but I, again, hope my views will be informed and useful. And finally, although I am an attorney for the U.S. EPA, I am probably not your personal attorney, and I'm not providing, through this presentation, any specific legal advice to any particular cases. Although, again, I hope that you find this material useful, and I will again encourage you to consult your own attorney for specific issues. So with that out of the way, next slide, 5. Why should we care about the U.S. Constitution? Well, you are probably a select group that is tuning in for this for some reason, hopefully because you care about the Constitution, but if you weren't sure about it, I think there are two really good reasons why everyone should care about the Constitution. One, it is the basis of our nation. It is the thing that really, truly unites us. It was the thing that almost created us. And if you're a federal employee, looking at slide number 5, you probably took this oath of office. I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of this office on which I'm about to enter, so help me God. That is a standard form that you probably signed if you didn't take it orally when you became a federal employee. For others who are not federal employees, you may have taken an oath of office that was very similar to this at some point. You know, people have lived and they have died to defend the Constitution, and I think that it's something that as civil servants we need to take very seriously. These are not just inconveniences that we'll talk about. These are your rights as well as the rights of others that we need to consider seriously in all the work that we do. If you click to the next slide, there is another good reason why we need to be concerned about the Constitution. And if you didn't think it was important to protect and defend the Constitution as a nation, you should know from a very personal perspective that you can be sued personally for a violation of the Constitution, something that is known as a Bivens claim. An alleged violation of constitutionally protected interests, giving rise to a claim for personal liability. The Bivens claim came from a case before the Supreme Court in 1971, Bivens versus 6 unknown agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. In that case, there was an individual who was arrested in his apartment in New York after agents kicked down the door, handcuffed him, conducted a strip search in front of the family, all without having a warrant obtained consistent with the Fourth Amendment. And the Supreme Court looked at this and said, this is shocking and horrible and should give rise to some personal liability. And, in fact, now it does in something called a Bivens claim. So if you blow the Constitution, it's possible that not only will the agency get in trouble, and it will, but you personally could be sued for that. And even though we tend to defend and win those cases, even having a lawsuit filed against you can be a really bad thing. It can take years to get it dismissed. You may have to hire your own private attorney if you're not represented fully by the Department of Justice. It will hang over you for credit rating purposes. So probably a good idea to try to avoid getting sued for violating someone's constitutional rights. Next slide. Hopefully you are convinced that the Constitution is important, and that's why you're calling in. But for people who say, I know my rights and have a healthy respect for the Constitution, and I've read the Constitution, it actually helps to read it and to start to understand it in some way that makes sense. And there is some structure and theme and cohesion to it. If you're looking at slide number 7, Constitution begins with an Article 1, the powers of Congress. Article 2, the powers of the executive, i.e. the president. Article 3, the powers of the judiciary, the court system. And there's other articles. Those are the big ones. And then finally you get to the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And we will talk about all of these in turn. So, next slide. Article 1, powers of Congress. There are enumerated powers of Congress. There are many powers of Congress. Here are some of them. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, to borrow money on the credit of the United States. That was a very key authority that has been much in discussion lately and concerning the debt ceiling and others. Congress has the power to declare war. And finally, and most particularly for our environmental purposes, the power to regulate commerce among the several states. And note some particular language there, not commerce within the states, but commerce among the several states. Next slide. That gives rise to the concept of interstate commerce, the regulation of interstate commerce. This is what we call the Commerce Clause, and there's lots and lots of case law about what the Commerce Clause means and how far that Commerce Clause authority goes. The very first test of the Commerce Clause authority really came up in the context of navigation, which is a word that has a lot of resonance for environmental regulation, particularly the Clean Water Act. For those OSDs who deal with Clean Water Act or Oil Pollution Act, you know that what is a navigable water is a key to our jurisdictional authority. And that focus on navigable water comes from the Commerce Clause. All America understands and has uniformly understood the word commerce to comprehend navigation. Those are words written by Chief Justice Marshall of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1824. Historical note, that case was argued successfully by Daniel Webster, the same author of the dictionary, who was arguing that states themselves could not individually regulate who gets to put their boats on rivers. That was a thing committed to the federal government under the Commerce Authority, and Daniel Webster prevailed. And so we now know that whatever commerce is, it certainly includes the right to regulate navigation. Next slide. But the Commerce Clause also extends beyond navigation, to be sure. And in the case known as the Shreveport rate cases, Congress took up the question of what about commerce that happens within a state that could have implications beyond that state. Here is a long quote. I just couldn't boil it down anymore. Congress, in the exercise of its paramount power, may prevent the common instrumentalities of interstate and intrastate commercial intercourse from being used in their intrastate operations to the injury of interstate. Goodness, what does that mean? Shreveport rate cases were about railroads, and some railroads cross state lines, and some railroads operate wholly within a state. In this case, the focus of the case was a railroad that operates wholly within a state. But if you're giving a special rate to intrastate, within the state, railroads, somehow that might prejudice other railroads that go beyond state lines. And the Supreme Court said, no, that was an unfair impact on interstate commerce. That thing that you're doing wholly within your own state has some injury to interstate commerce, and therefore that wholly intrastate operation can be regulated by the federal government under the Commerce Clause power. And in fact, this case gave rise to the very first regulatory agency of the federal government. That is the Interstate Commerce Commission. They gave it a name to make sure that it was very clearly grounded in the Commerce Clause. The Interstate Commerce Commission, now known as the Surface Transportation Board, was designed to regulate things like railroads. Whether or not they cross state lines, they can have an effect on interstate commerce, and that is something that Congress can reach. And if Congress can reach railroads within a state, Congress can reach other things that happen within states, such as water pollution. And this gives rise to the ability of the federal government to regulate things that happen within states. Without the Shreveport rate cases, there's no ICC, there's no EPA, there's no federal regulation. Next slide. So the Commerce Clause authority is pretty broad. It could regulate things like baking. If you're baking bread in Iowa and somehow injuring interstate commerce because you're injuring other bakers in other states, Congress can regulate lots of things that happen within states. But if there's a pendulum that swings back and forth on how broad the Commerce Clause can be recognized, it may be that the pendulum is swinging back towards a more narrow view of how far it goes. Here's a quote from a Supreme Court case in 2001 that environmental people may know well. Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County says, "The grant of authority to Congress under the Commerce Clause, though broad, is not unlimited. There are limits to how far the Commerce Clause can go." Next slide. And in that particular case, Swank, the court found that petitioner's gravel pit is a far cry indeed from the navigable waters and waters of the United States to which the Clean Water Act applies. The Clean Water Act can regulate a lot of waters, and they don't have to cross state lines, but it seems the Supreme Court is saying at some point there may be some water that is not subject to the Clean Water Act, that is not navigable, that does not affect interstate commerce. The Congress does not regulate bathwater. And, you know, what about drinking water? What about other forms of water that are not navigable or not within the definition of waters of the U.S.? The Supreme Court is just telling us there may be some limit to what the Commerce Clause can reach here. And that may be a hint that we need to respect it. Well, it wasn't that much longer that we had another Supreme Court case on the Clean Water Act, slide 13, known as Rapanos, in the year 2006. In that case, the court, or at least some portion of it, said the Corps' interpretation of waters of the United States stretches the outer limits of Congress's commerce power. There was some discussion about the migratory bird rule, and does water include anywhere a duck could land? Well, does that necessarily have an impact on interstate commerce? The court, again, is reminding us that the Commerce Clause power only goes so far. And when we have to do these things like make out jurisdictional waters and show how this is waters of the U.S., it's not because we're inventing new hurdles for ourselves. It's really because we need to respect the limits of the Constitution as established in the Commerce Clause. Next. Any questions on Article 1, Commerce Clause, or anything at all, at any time, please break in here, because if I was doing this live, this would be much more of a conversation. It's kind of a weird thing to be talking into a phone here. So please feel free to raise anything. Moving on from Article 1, Powers of Congress, we could talk about Article 2, Powers of the Executive, i.e. the President of the United States. If you recognize this picture, here is the current president who is taking the oath of office, which is not just a good idea, but if you click the next slide, the Constitution specifically requires the president to take an oath of office. And not any particular oath, but the framers of the Constitution actually wrote that oath right into Article 2. "I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." These words are, if anything, is magic. And the framers thought it was so important that they wrote this oath right in there. And if you recall, if you were watching the inauguration, you may recall a little historical oddity that when this oath of office was administered by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to Barack Obama, the Chief Justice got these words wrong. In fact, moved that word faithfully. "I will execute the office faithfully," and the president, through respect perhaps for the Chief Justice, followed the erroneous syntax that the Chief Justice had offered. And if you remember the conclusion of that story, after taking this public oath, they went back to the White House and took another oath with these exact words in this exact order to make very sure that the president was in fact sworn in properly. So this stuff is really important. And these words will come up again and again. What does it mean to faithfully execute? If some of these words start to sound familiar, this is where our own oath of office comes in for federal employees. And we'll talk about what these words mean, because it's not just about the president. It's about all of us who are sworn to protect the Constitution. Next slide. Later in Article 2, under powers of the executive, we find this phrase, the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Again, we're seeing that language that appears in the oath of office, that the laws be faithfully executed. It's the same words that appear in our own civil servants' oath of office. And this is a clause that has come to be known as the take care clause. What does it mean for the president or anyone to take care that the laws be faithfully executed? What does it mean that the laws be executed faithfully? Is that something different than just executed? What does this word faithfully really mean? If we were having a dialogue about this, and I would love to hear your thoughts about it, but the way the courts have taken a look at this word, faithfully means true to the essence, true to the purpose in some way, but not necessarily literally executed blindly without any further judgment or discretion. And that is actually a key word. Next slide, 17, starts to pick up on this idea of what it means for a federal agency, an environmental agency, to faithfully execute the laws. This leads us to the concept of what prosecutors would know as prosecutorial discretion, or what other agencies may know as enforcement discretion. Just because there is a violation of the Clean Water Act, or just because jurisdiction under Superfund is somehow triggered, it doesn't mean that every agency, every time, must take an action to enforce the law. In fact, we know wherever you sit, there are probably limited resources available to you. And we have to choose where we are going to act and how we are going to use our limited resources. And our failure to enforce in every single case is not something that is subject to judicial review. And that is pretty clear from the case law, and specifically clear in the case of enforcement by the U.S. EPA. One of the most recent cases that tried to sue EPA for failure to enforce the Clean Water Act came up in a case known as Sierra Club versus Whitman, Christine Todd Whitman, then the EPA administrator. And the court there said it was unwise for the judiciary to attempt to set priorities for EPA enforcement. Yes, there was a violation of the Clean Water Act in the state of Arizona. Yes, EPA had the authority to respond under the Clean Water Act. But EPA does not have the obligation to enforce every time. Yes, we are taking care that the laws be faithfully executed, but that doesn't mean we have to do it every single time. And in fact, we couldn't. And courts are not going to step in and try to make us do that every single time. But, next slide. What about the opposite scenario? What if EPA, for example, decided that we were not going to enforce the Clean Water Act whatsoever? Not only are we not going to fail to enforce it at this one case in Arizona, but we're just not going to enforce the Clean Water Act. Imagine further that we were so committed to this position of not enforcing the law that we had abolished our enforcement office at EPA. That's not a hypothetical, actually. It happened. In 1982, there was new political appointees for the U.S. EPA, and that was a very real case. The Office of Enforcement was indeed abolished. And is that consistent with our duty to faithfully execute the laws of the United States? Query, and I could leave that question hanging, but there are consequences of that kind of pendulum swing. The EPA administrator at that time, Ann Gorsuch, was called before Congress to answer questions. And apparently lied to Congress and was held in contempt of Congress and very quickly resigned her position as EPA administrator. About the same time, she had appointed an assistant administrator for Superfund, Rita Lavelle. Rita Lavelle was convicted of perjury for lying to Congress and actually went to jail for 3 months and also resigned. Later, out here in Seattle, EPA Region 10, we had a regional administrator who apparently did not want to do enforcement against mining companies here in the Northwest. And there was an investigation by the Inspector General, and that led to the resignation of that particular regional administrator. So there are obligations to faithfully execute. And there may be consequences if we decided not to do it whatsoever. On the other hand, of course, you're not going to make us enforce every single time. We always have discretion, and we always need to use it to the best of our ability. So much for the cautionary tales. Somewhere in the middle is probably the right way to be there. Next slide. Number 19, Article 3, Powers of the Judiciary. Article 3 of the Constitution creates the concept of federal courts. And, you know, there are many courts out there to which cases may be brought. In the state of Washington, we appear in superior courts and municipal courts. But there are federal courts with federal district judges. And as a federal agency, this is probably where we would be bringing our cases. But federal courts have limited jurisdiction. The judicial power shall extend to all cases and controversies arising under the Constitution, federal law, or other enumerated matters. It's not everything that gets into federal court. It's specific kinds of questions, and they need to be in the form of a case or controversy. So what does that mean? Next slide. Well, a case or controversy allows us to bring lawsuits where we have some actual dispute, where we have parties that we are disputing against. We can sue parties who we believe have violated the environmental laws. We can sue parties who owe us money. What we can't do is sue parties who we don't believe are liable or in violation. We can't file lawsuits speculatively, thinking that someone may at some point break the law is not a case that we could actually take to federal court. In the Superfund world, someone is preparing or proposing or prospectively purchasing some contaminated property. Well, until they actually acquire that contaminated property, they may not be liable, and we can't sue them for their prospects of acquiring environmental liability. Who else can we sue? Well, let's look at the next slide. Slide number 21, really what we're talking about is who can't we sue? We can't sue parties who are not liable yet. We can't sue parties based on hypotheticals. And for the federal government, EPA cannot sue other agencies of the federal government. We do not bring cases against the U.S. Navy, for example, in federal court. There is a theory espoused by the U.S. Department of Justice that we are all one unified executive, and therefore the United States cannot sue the United States, and therefore we EPA cannot sue Navy, Army, or other kinds of things. We cannot sue in federal court, but we can, and we do bring cases against other federal agencies in other kinds of courts, most particularly in administrative courts. If you're familiar with the system we have of administrative law judges, we can, and we do, bring enforcement cases against other federal agencies in the administrative law system, and we argue hearings before administrative law judges. But Article III courts are those federal district courts created by the Constitution, and we can't bring cases there because that's not a case or controversy. Okay, we're moving on from the Articles of the Constitution. There are others about how constitutions are ratified and so on, but not so important for OSC purposes. Again, I would invite any questions concerning any of the articles or anything as we go along. But moving into the Bill of Rights, this is where we get a lot of interesting issues that may be implicated in work of on-scene coordinators. And I would say this is probably true generally of work concerning any cleanup operation under the Superfund statute or even state laws, because even state laws are subject to the Constitution. So let's take a look at the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's a big, big chunk of constitutional law right there, and it's all under the First Amendment, and in order to really understand what that means, we're going to need to break that down, so we shall. Let's go to the next slide, 23.
Before you go any further, we had a question coming online. This is an anonymous question.
Yes.
And they just asked generally, where does the OSC get his or her powers? Isn't it part of the CFR?
Very good question. Thank you for raising that. The power of the OSC comes from two different sources. One, if we're talking about federal OSCs in particular, the Superfund statute confers authorities largely on the President of the United States. And then those authorities are delegated down through a series of delegation from the President to the Administrator of EPA, to regional administrators, and ultimately to the on-scene coordinator. There are, however, some provisions of CERCLA, and actually the Clean Water Act, that specifically confer authorities on the administrator or the Corps of Engineers. And those authorities are delegated down to the OSC. And there are actually a few occasions where this were written right into the statute. Section 107D of CERCLA, for example, actually says on-scene coordinator. And so on-scene coordinators have authority right there under the statute. It's a pretty extraordinary conferring of authority from Congress directly to an individual position. The important thing to understand is that whatever Congress says in the statute or whatever an agency says through its delegations or rules, all of it must be consistent with the Constitution of the United States. Nothing that Congress can say or the President can be inconsistent with the Constitution, which is a really good reason to talk about the Constitution today. So if you were going through the CFR, as you mentioned, and you see these authorities of the OSC, that's really good to know what we've said in our rule book, but you also have to read that consistent with the Constitution, which is why we're talking about the Constitution here. And I hope that answers the question, but if not, feel free to write back. So let's take a look at the Constitution, and that applies to on-scene coordinators and everyone else. The First Amendment begins, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Two different concepts. We don't promote religion, we don't prohibit the exercise of religion. And you might think, well, how would an OSC do either of those? Well, let's take a look at some scenarios. Number 24 establishes a general proposition. Total separation of church and state is not possible in an absolute sense. Some relationship between government and religious organizations is inevitable. You probably heard in popular media, you know, the separation of church and state. And that may be true in some sense as an aspiration. But when it comes right down to it, as the Supreme Court is recognizing here in this case from 1971, total separation is really not possible. We are inextricably linked as a government to religious organizations. The question is, to what extent is that really permissible? And we run into questions very quickly. Let's look at the first scenario on slide number 25. You're in a rural area, and there's no public building other than the church, and you propose to use a church building for a public meeting. Is that okay? I'd love to hear from folks on the phone at this point, because my bet is that someone here has probably held a public meeting in a church building. I'm one of them. We've had them in very interesting church buildings. But we have done that because we are not respecting the establishment of religion. We're not prohibiting it. But we are trying to achieve some other purpose, like holding a public meeting, providing information. And it sometimes happens that the church is the only facility that will really house people for that purpose. And so we have not found that to be a offensive to the First Amendment church and state issue. Let's look at the next scenario, slide 26. Use of a church parking lot for a staging area. We've had on-scene coordinators go into a community, into a residential neighborhood, and the only place that has space available to park all the emergency response vehicles off the street is a church parking lot. And churches have granted us access to park our equipment on the church parking lot. But what happens when all of our equipment is still there on Sunday morning and the churchgoers themselves can't use that parking lot? We need to be careful about these issues. Someone could say that we're prohibiting the free exercise if people can no longer get to their church because we're consuming their parking lot. And yet we have used parking lots. We just need to be sensitive that we're not affecting or prohibiting anyone's free exercise by doing that. So, next scenario, slide 27. use of church members to distribute information on asbestos hazards. Is that legitimate? Well, as it turns out, that some churches and some communities is the best social structure that we may have for distributing information. Some particular faith-based organizations have been out in the forefront of environmental issues. The whole environmental justice movement was linked with faith-based communities early on in that development. And we do, in fact, have interactions with faith-based communities, and we have, in fact, used churches to help distribute information to people who live in a community, not because we're attempting to endorse one faith over another, but because those are some of the social structures that may be most reliable to get environmental information to a local community. Let's take a look at another scenario. Slide 28, an opening prayer before a public meeting. I'd be interested to hear if anyone has ever had an opening prayer before a public meeting. I have. I think that it's perhaps more increasingly common, and maybe even more so in communities that we might identify as an environmental justice community. If the local church is the only social structure, it's probably likely that they're going to want to open a public meeting with a prayer, and it won't be ours, and we won't write it as an agency, but we won't prohibit anyone from doing that. In the West, when we're working on Indian territory, Native American country, they will very often open a meeting with some kind of prayer as well. And as an agency, we will respect their right to do that. Again, it's not going to be an agency drafting the words of that prayer, but we will not stop anyone from doing that in the ordinary course. Let's take a look at one more scenario here, slide 29. Imagine that there was an oath of office for the President of the United States or for a federal employment that ended with the phrase, "So help me God." If you can remember back to slide 5, I believe it, this is not a hypothetical. This is written right there into our oath of office. And I said at the beginning that if you were a federal employee, you probably took the oath of office, and you probably said these words, "So help me God." But as a consequence of the First Amendment, you actually do have the right to opt out of saying those words. And on your OPM form, you could check a box and raise an argument that it would be offensive to your religion to say that. But in the ordinary oath of office, it's right there, and I guess that has not been deemed to be offensive to the First Amendment.
Cliff, we had a comment that came in online, and this is coming in from Edison, New Jersey, from the EPA, and they were just mentioning that sometimes these groups are your target groups that you're trying to educate. I think this is a reference to some of the religious organizations.
Thank you very much for that, and that's really important. I've heard that there are religious uses for mercury and for some other things that we would consider as hazardous substances, and there may be certain practices or just localities where we really do need to reach those specific communities because of our environmental concerns, and that's absolutely right, that sometimes there's a reason why we need to reach this particular group of individuals, and it may be that the local faith community is not only a convenient structure for doing that, but those are the very people that we need to protect. So I really appreciate that comment. Okay. There is a test. There is a general test for whether government activity does or does not offend the church and state concerns of the First Amendment. And the most perhaps relevant factor is there a secular purpose? Is there a reason why we are doing what we're doing? Not because we're promoting or prohibiting some religious practice, but because we are concerned about, for example, protection of public health. The example that was just raised by the comment, the point that was raised by the comment, I think, is particularly appropriate here. We're not concerned about the religious practice. We're concerned about the exposure of people to this hazardous substance. We want to make sure that our government activity does not have a primary effect to advance or inhibit religion. It's not about that. It's protecting the environment. It's those things that the statute charges us to do. And there's also kind of a catch-all factor. excessive entanglements of government with religion. It might be hard to provide an example of that, but if we deferred all of the work somehow to faith-based community, and at some point it could be too much. And I haven't seen any cases of that yet, but we do need to be careful that we still, as an agency, as a government, retain our individual authority. We retain the focus on what we're doing, why we're doing it, and just make that clear. Moving on from religion, slide 31, still under the First Amendment, we could talk about freedom of speech and the press. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Pretty straightforward and pretty powerful. It may be that we're not supposed to choose among, you know, favorite children and favorite phrases in the Constitution, but you see that the freedom of speech and of the press are held with extraordinary regard, regardless of any political persuasion in the case law of the U.S. Supreme Court on down. And freedom of speech and of the press are one of those things that really define us as a free country in some ways. And we need to be very sensitive to that. Let's take a look at some scenarios on how that may have implications for the work of an OSC. Slide 32, scenario. You're attending a public meeting, and there's one loud, angry citizen monopolizing the floor. If you've been to a public meeting, you may very well have been a witness to this scenario. And it's a big and continuing challenge, I think, for agencies to manage that kind of scenario. On the one hand, you certainly don't want to cut off anyone's rights of freedom of speech. On the other hand, if you think about one person monopolizing the discussion, you could say that you are infringing on the freedom of speech of everyone else who also came to that public meeting and wants to be heard. It's a big challenge for public meetings. There was a national meeting, I understand, and 2 weeks ago in the D.C. area that was talking about this concept of hijacking of public meetings. And there are techniques that community involvement coordinators are using for that. Just understand that freedom of speech definitely comes up in this kind of context. Yes, we need to let people talk, but we need to make sure that we're letting all people talk who want to talk. And at some point, it would certainly be appropriate for an agency to move on from one loud, angry person and make sure that everyone has their ability and right to be heard. Next slide. You have finished your public meeting and you're chatting with citizens afterwards, and in your private chat with citizens afterwards, you express a strong opinion about a partisan candidate running for office. You can't believe that bozo is getting anyone to support his campaign at all. Something of that nature. Well, understand that as a government person, you may be held to certain responsibilities when it comes to partisan speech. And if you're a federal employee, you should be very familiar with the Hatch Act that recognizes the First Amendment rights of federal employees, but also puts some restrictions on what we can say in particular scenarios. I'll just put it that. I'm not going to provide any specific advice on the Hatch Act now. Just understand that, yes, even federal employees have First Amendment rights, but, yes, we need to know how to use them responsibly. And as a condition of employment, sometimes we either accept those limitations or we don't accept the employment. Let's take another scenario, slide 34. You're on an emergency response. You have lots of media interest, and reporters are seeking entry to the hot zone. Everyone else from the agency is there dressed up in Tyvek and level A, and then you've got a reporter with a microphone and a camera who wants to go into that same place. Do you let them? Do you call this freedom of the press, and are the press allowed to go anywhere? I'm hoping that no one's going to say that the press have unrestricted access everywhere. At some point, you would think that issues of self-preservation would tend to limit that. But I have seen cases where reporters do feel like they could just walk onto the site regardless of the hazards that we have identified or suspected. So there needs to be some limitations on freedom of the press, even in the case of work that we're doing, particularly in the emergency response mode. Also understand that when we talk about access later under the Fourth Amendment, government agencies obtain access for government agencies. We do not obtain access on behalf of private organizations. We do not confer access upon the press or others. They have their own responsibilities, and if they violate them, then they could be responsible for trespass or other things. So we can certainly establish safety conditions and also understand that they, the press, have their own legal obligations for access as well. Another scenario, slide 35, some tragic case involving mercury poisoning. You have victims in the hospital. Media is circling, and reporters are seeking to get the lab results from urine samples. Not a distant hypothetical. We had such a case in Region 10 a few years back. And one morning we woke up to unfold the paper, and there on the front page above the fold was reported the precise concentration of urine in one of those mercury victims. And hopefully people are recognizing that this could be a pretty severe violation of someone's privacy rights, particularly a violation of the Federal Privacy Act. Yes, we want to share public information. Yes, we believe in open government. But there are countervailing concerns as well. We need to maintain the privacy of medical records. We need to maintain the privacy of financial records in certain circumstances. And there are legal consequences for violating that as well that we need to understand. Yes, there is a freedom of speech. Yes, a freedom of press. But it needs to be balanced with other concerns as well. In that case, we were somewhat relieved to find that whoever had leaked the concentration of mercury in urine did not come from the US EPA. Unfortunately, some other local government didn't seem to have that same sensitivity to medical information and had shared it with the press, and there it was on the front page. And imagine if you were the parent of that child, you would have been very unhappy to find that as well. And I would too, as a parent. Let's dig deeper into the First Amendment. It's not just about freedom of religion and speech and press. Congress shall make no law, slide 36, abridging the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. More rights at the heart of our free country, peaceably to assemble. It is modified, not just a mob. But if the mob assembles, they need to assemble peaceably. Slide 37, imagine a scenario. We have some incident happening. There is an incident command post. Mob is very unhappy about our cleanup objectives, cleanup plan. They have stage a sit-in inside the incident command post. Is that okay? Are they exercising their First Amendment rights? Are you going to haul them out of there? These are some tricky situations, and again, I can't tell you what the answer to all of these are. I could tell you that the First Amendment itself says not an unconditional right to assemble, but they must assemble peaceably. And to that, I would also say they need to respect our ability to do work as well. And if anyone is obstructing our work, then there are remedies that we could use to address that as well. But these are really good times, I will say again and again, to consult with your own legal counsel to consider what are the implications here, what are the rights of the First Amendment, what are some of the other countervailing concerns. Now, moving on from the mob sitting in at the incident command post, next slide, 38, mob decides to sit in the command post with firearms. Hopefully by this point you're seeing that there is a real concern, and that perhaps bringing firearms is not indicative of peaceably assembling. If you are in a federal building, there are probably an outright prohibition on bringing firearms into your federal building without specific authority, such as being a federal marshal. And at this point, you would probably be bringing in law enforcement to help contain that situation. This is a somewhat titled Second Amendment. Yes, there are Second Amendment rights, which agencies must respect, because that's the Constitution. On the other hand, again, there are limitations to that, and you should always be sensitive to issues on either side and consult your legal counsel. At this point, again, I would invite questions at any time, but we're about to leap into what may be the most significant issue recurring for on-scene coordinators, that is the Fourth Amendment. Okay, let's jump in. Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The right of the people to be secure in a person's houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Slide 40. Let's take another look at that same phrase. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. I don't know, because I wasn't around in the year 1789, but I suspect that the key words here, persons, houses, papers, and effects, were written with some sense of order or priority in mind. What does it mean to be secure in your person, or your house, or your papers, or effects? We're going to talk about each one of those, because they really do come up in context that OSCs will face as they carry out their work. Let's move on to the next slide, 41. What does it mean to be right? What does it mean to be secure in your persons? If I could see a show of hands, I would ask how many people have ever been subject to a body search? And if you're thinking about that, I would say probably all of you have been subject to a search of your person. If you have been through an airport in the last 5 years, you have, in fact, been subject to a search. The Fourth Amendment doesn't say that you are not subject to a search. It simply says you're not subject to an unreasonable search or seizure. But in terms of expectation of privacy, expectation of security, there is probably the highest level of expectation of privacy for persons. As an EPA, OSC, there is probably little opportunity for conducting search of persons, but it does happen. For example, if we are taking blood samples, lead or mercury, you could say that is a search. And if we have that information in our possession, you will know that it is entitled to the highest level of privacy and security. Most of the time, we're not conducting searches of persons, but it does happen. Let's move on to the next slide, 42. Houses. Right of the people to be secure in their houses shall not be violated. What is a house? Let's talk about what is a house. Do we search houses? Next slide. 43. Here is a lovely photo of a site that EPA Region 10 investigated and addressed last summer, very much this time last summer. 3,400 drums were found out on this rural residential property. Are we conducting a search? Absolutely we are. Are we conducting a search of a house? Does anyone see a house in this picture? You should see lots of drums in the foregrounds, but is there a house? Are we going to search it? Let's take that look at the next slide, and I'll help you out. Slide 44, do you see a house now? Slide 45, do you see a house now? Do you see more than one house? In fact, you may see many houses at the same site. While you may be distracted by the 3,000 drums in the foreground, you may see a blue house hiding behind some junk. You may see what may be a silo, or someone may call it a yurt, something like a tent. You may see a barn in the bottom left corner, but if a person is living there, it could be a house. You may see an old abandoned Winnebago. You may see a junk car. All of those things, under the law, can be considered a house for purposes of the Fourth Amendment, and we need to be very sensitive to that. A house is not just a thing with a white picket fence. If you look at slide 46, there's actually a fairly useful definition. Moving away from the word house, which may connote picket fence, federal law and federal regulations really use the term a dwelling. And this is one definition of a dwelling, a place of permanent or customary and usual residence of a person according to local custom or law. It may be that this person is trespassing. It may be that they're squatting. It may be that they have no legal right whatsoever to be on a piece of property, but it is still the local custom to park your van down by the river. It is still the local custom to pitch your tent underneath the freeway overpass. Those are dwellings. Those may be houses for purposes of the Constitution. People have some expectation of privacy, even in the tent, underneath the freeway overpass. And those are things that we need to understand and respect as we carry out our work for OSCs. So,
Chris, we have a question that came in online.
Yes.
This is coming in from EPA in Edison, New Jersey, and it's in reference to the photos you were just showing.
Mm-hmm.
They ask, what happens when you need to dispose of these items like paper? How do you assess value to photos? People demand for decon of these items and the 100% assurance that their exposure is zero.
Yeah, that is a big question, and I'm going to answer it squarely in just a few more slides.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely. And understand that while we may be dealing with a house as a tent or house as a car or house or other things, just moving on to slide 47, keep in mind the bottom line here. People have a right to be secure in a person's house with papers and effects. It doesn't mean that they have a right to exclude or deny legal authority. It just means that we cannot conduct unreasonable searches and seizures. And if we need to go beyond search and seizure to actually do something more, we could do that too. This is really establishing where people have that right and what is the level of that right, because they're different. Let's look at a person's house's papers. What does it mean to be securing your papers? Well, in 1789, they're not talking about newspapers, although they did have them. This is really about commercial paper. We were talking then about businessmen, about merchants, who had some expectation of privacy in their private business. And if you extend that to modern-day concerns, let's look at slide 48. That issue came up in a very big way in a Supreme Court case known as Dow Chemical versus, no surprise, U.S. EPA, 1986. In this case, we're not dealing with security of a person or a house. We're dealing with the interest in an industrial facility, a huge 2,000-acre industrial facility where EPA was seeking to obtain access. Our inspectors were denied access, and EPA said, okay, we'll get on an airplane. We'll fly over this 2,000-acre facility and take photographs. And Dow Chemical objected to that later on after it was done, and before the U.S. District Court actually won on that case. The District Court said Dow Chemical has a reasonable expectation of privacy in a 2,000-acre industrial facility. However, on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, that decision was ultimately reversed. Not because Dow Chemical didn't have an expectation of privacy, but because, quote here, for commercial property, the expectation of privacy differs significantly from the sanctity accorded in an individual's home. So remember that tiering, person, house, then paper, commercial property. Yes, you have an expectation of privacy in a commercial setting, but it's not the same. It's not as level of sanctity as an individual's home. Yes, EPA can, and now, yes, EPA does do aerial photography. However, footnote, and a historical footnote, an electronic device to penetrate walls or windows so as to hear and record confidential discussions would raise very different and far more serious questions. Now, this, I think, is very interesting because the Supreme Court is writing 25 years ago, anticipating the development of technology. And if you go to OSC readiness training today, and they always have these technology presentations and all the heavy equipment out in the parking lot, you know that there's a lot of technology available that can penetrate lots of structures. And at some point, it begins to raise questions of, is this an illegal search? You stand on the sidewalk and you aim some gun through a wall, and now you're recording information out within the home, within that area. No tidy answer to that. Just understand that was a question that the Supreme Court was clearly anticipating 25 years ago, and it's still a relevant question today. But very clearly, EPA has the authority. If commercial aircraft can fly it, EPA can fly it. If people can sit by the window of an airplane and take pictures, well, EPA can do the same. We flew over the Gulf, back and forth during the deep water horizon. All that is certainly fine. We use infrared in mining areas to look for contamination. But at some point, technology can go too far, especially when we're penetrating the interior of buildings. So just be sensitive to that. Finally, slide 49, Fourth Amendment, persons, house, papers, and effects. What are effects? Well, other personal objects. Your laptop computer, for example. You don't expect anyone to simply open it up and start reading stuff off of there. Federal agencies can and do obtain warrants to search laptop computers. You don't expect anyone to look through your wallet or your purse. You have expectation of privacy, but maybe not the same level of privacy as if they were to search your person or your house. Effects is also a significant thing that could be searched and in which you have some expectation of privacy and others do as well. Slide 50. So we have persons, house, papers, and effects. What does it mean to have an unreasonable search or a seizure? Search or seizure. Two different words, two different concepts. Let's explore that a little bit as well. Back to this site. This was Rexburg, Idaho last summer. We have reports of 3,000 drums fuming in a very dangerous formation. The first thing we need to do is gather some more information. We're going to conduct a search. You may call it in Superfund terminology an assessment or an investigation, but it's a search, and we just need to understand that's what we're doing. That's what the Supreme Court calls it. We're going to need to comply with the Fourth Amendment as we do our search. We're also going to think about seizure. Not only are we going to see and photograph and sample these drums, but maybe we're going to take them away. Well, okay, the Fourth Amendment says we could do that. We can't be unreasonable. But we may move from search at some point to seizure. We're going to take them. And if that's what we're doing, we just need to be very deliberate about it and make sure we're complying with the Fourth Amendment as well. The Fourth Amendment continues. Slide 52. Beyond search and seizure, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. I mentioned that I'm a part-time academic, and I've taught writing courses, and usually when you're talking about the Constitution, it requires some kind of interpretation, but in this case, it's a little eerie that the framers of the Constitution are telling us through this clause precisely what we need to put in an application for a warrant for access. One, the Constitution begins with this concept of warrants. Not there shall be warrants, but no warrant shall issue. They already knew what a warrant was. This is the standard for getting one, probable cause. If you grew up on detective shows, you probably hear about probable cause. If you have any law enforcement connection, you hear it there. But understand that probable cause here applies to any search or seizure, not just a criminal search. But a big caveat to that is that what probable cause means may be very different whether you're in a criminal context or a civil context. You still need probable cause for a search, even under CERCLA, but you just need to know what probable cause means in there, and we'll talk about that. Supported by oath or affirmation, today that probably means an affidavit or a declaration. We need someone who saw something and can write it up, often signed by an OSC, but it could be someone else. And that warrant application needs to particularly describe the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. We're going to break that down. Probable cause is different whether you're seeking a criminal warrant or a civil or administrative warrant. In the criminal context, probable cause means something like you have a reasonable basis to believe that someone has committed a crime, has broken a law. For CERCLA purposes, Superfund, civil, administrative, we don't need to think that someone has acted badly or broken a law. Probable cause standard is written right into CERCLA itself, section 104E1. A reasonable basis to believe that there may be a release or threat of release of a hazardous substance or pollutant or contaminant. Not that we believe that someone is wrong, broke a law, not that we believe that someone is in danger. A reasonable basis to believe that there may be a release or threat of release of a hazardous substance or pollutant or contaminant. That is the standard that we would need to establish. Not that we even know it, we just need a reasonable basis to believe it. Oath or affirmation. Usually when we're applying for a warrant, it means a signed declaration or affidavit. It could also mean oral testimony. OSCs can appear before a federal magistrate and be put under oath and say, I was out there, I stood on the property line, I saw 3,000 drums, they appeared to be fuming. I understand they came from paint, recycling company, and I have reason to believe there's hazardous substance. But it needs to be under oath, and it probably means a signed declaration will accompany the warrant application. And now, oath or affirmation declarations can come from other sources, too. It may be an OSC. It may be a civil investigator. In this case, slide 55, here's an example of a declaration signed by a fire chief. The fire department of Madison County was the first one on the scene at the Rexburg drum site last summer. They went on the property under their own authority. They didn't find a fire. They found 3,000 drums of fuming stuff. They took photos, they backed out, and they wrote us this lovely declaration that we used in our application for the warrant. It may be a police officer, it may be someone else who actually saw something and can swear to what they saw to help us establish probable cause. Slide 56. Fourth Amendment continues, particularly describing the place to be searched. We need to be very particular about this. The Constitution actually says so. And here's an example of what it means to particularly describe the place to be searched. In this case, property located at street address 6545 South 2000 West, Rexburg, Idaho. Legal description of Township 5, Range 39, County Tax Parcel RP 05N39. A narrative description includes a single-story, single-family dwelling. Remember that word, dwelling. Blue in color. Also includes an outbuilding described as 8 by 12 feet and all those vehicles we saw out and a number of old vehicles in various states of disrepair. If you want to search the house, if you want to search the outbuilding, if you want to search the old vehicles, you need to particularly describe them in your warrant application. This is what that means. Particularly describing the persons to be seized, that applies if you're going to arrest someone, which is unlikely. Particularly describing slide 57, things to be seized. What kind of things do OSCs seize? Well, in this case, they're going to seize approximately 3,000 individual containers. They're stored on plastic, otherwise exposed to the element. These things. We're going to obtain drums. We're going to obtain other contaminated soils, but we need to describe them in some ways. And we could do it. We can seize it, but we need to particularly describe it. And if you're working with an attorney, be sure that they understand clearly what it is that you intend to do on that. And if you intend to seize anything, be sure we get that in there as well. Slide 58, if you do it right, you have your warrant application, you have your declarations, you have your particularly describing statements, you can and you should prevail in your pursuit of a warrant. There are different kinds of warrants, and you should understand that. Slide 58 is an example of a warrant that gives access to enter the property to conduct an assessment, to conduct sampling and inspection. If you turn to the next slide, 59, in this particular case, we got on the site, we found 3,000 drums in a very dangerous situation, and a week later, actually just a few days later, we put together a warrant application that would allow us not only to inspect and sample, but to remove those drums, to seize them. Slide 59 is an example of administrative warrant authorizing implementation of response actions. So understand that there are different kinds of warrants. The first one was a search warrant. The second one was a seizure warrant. Before we leave the Fourth Amendment, I would just make a note that anytime we go onto private property, we could be facing these issues under the Fourth Amendment. And understand again that if we blow it, we can be sued. Personally, that was the Bivens case. That was a Fourth Amendment case. If we enter illegally, it may mean that we have eliminated the possibility of recovering costs after the fact. If we discover evidence of criminal activity, it may mean that we have eliminated the possibility of criminal prosecution. And it may mean that people are subject not only to constitutional claims, but good old-fashioned due process, good old-fashioned trespass. And we certainly don't want to have any of that hanging over an agency or any individual. Again, if you're acting within the scope of the employment, if you're an OSC, it's your job to enter the property, we can defend those things and almost always prevail, but you certainly don't want to have the case hanging over your head while it takes years sometimes to get those dismissed. So the Fourth Amendment may happen almost any single time you're going onto anyone's private property. Usually you don't hear about it because we get access by consent. And it just means that it's a really good idea to get that consent in writing so there's no questions about it after the fact. Okay, I want to invite any questions on the Fourth Amendment at this time, entry, property, anything like that. I'll take a sip of water and we'll move on to slide 60, the Fifth Amendment. Okay, the Fifth Amendment. If you ask people if they're aware of their Fifth Amendment rights, they're probably going to think of the right against self-incrimination. I invoke my Fifth Amendment rights. But if you read the Fifth Amendment, it's a really big amendment. It has a lot of stuff in there. And it's certainly worth reading. I guess at this point I would also mention when I've done this presentation live and in person over a number of years or pieces of it, I would often provide actual pocket copies of the U.S. Constitution. I'm a big fan of people actually having and knowing their constitutional rights and having it with them. Although now, since I'm not with you personally, I could suggest that there is an app for that. If you go to U.S. Constitution, you could find a wonderful free app to have the Constitution with you, and you could read the Fifth Amendment and every other part of the Constitution in all its glory. So check it out. Fifth Amendment, no person, .. shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Life, liberty, or property, if that phrase rings any bell, it may be because you are remembering the more common formulation, life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness, if you've heard that, if it sounds more familiar, comes not from the Constitution, but from the Declaration of Independence, 1776. Thomas Jefferson and French Enlightenment. But by the time 1789 comes around, we have somehow dropped the pursuit of happiness. And really what our Constitution, our country about is life, liberty, or property. Property is going to be really key for purposes of work of an OSC. Unfortunately, happiness, seems to have no part in that specifically. And the Constitution doesn't say that we can't deprive people of life, liberty, or property. We can deprive people of life, liberty, or property. We just can't do it without due process of law. And what due process of law is a very big discussion, but we'll try to break it down into something meaningful. But two ways to look at due process, slide 61, substantive due process or procedural due process. Let's take a look at substantive due process first. Slide 62. If you were a law student, if you've gone to law school, you could study due process for a full semester. One thing you'd probably be told, at least I was 20 years ago, was that substantive due process was essentially dead. That substantive due process was a concept that a law or a government action was so bad that it just offended the very concept of due process. And it's really hard to be that bad these days, but we can still try, and people still make out arguments that you have violated my substantive due process. That thing was so bad, you violated my due process rights. Imagine this. The worst terror strike on U.S. soil, asbestos by the tons floating through the air, and you rush out to ground zero to tell everyone that everything is okay. Is that a hypothetical? I don't know, but there was a case, Benzman versus Christine Todd Whitman, a class action by residents and workers in Lower Manhattan affected by the events of 9/11 and statements that Whitman may have made at the time. The claim was that false statements by the EPA administrator deprived the plaintiffs of the truth about dust from the World Trade Center. And when you deprive them of the truth about that dust, you deprive them of the opportunity to take health precautions. A pretty bold claim, perhaps, and without commenting on the veracity of it, that claim carried on for some time. Let's take a look at the next slide. When the district court looked at that claim, the district court agreed with the plaintiffs that the plaintiff's claim today is a violation of clearly established substantive due process rights to be free from official government policies that increase the risk of bodily harm. That if it's true that the government is lying to people about the dangers of that World Trade Center dust, that is just so bad, it affects substantive due process. You deprive people of the ability to understand and protect themselves from bodily harm. And the case was not dismissed. It proceeded up onto appeal before the Second Circuit. When the Second Circuit looked at this, and again, I mentioned the threat of personal liability. This is Christine Todd Whitman personally, as well as EPA. When the Second Circuit looked at this, they found that the standard for substantive due process came down to something like that conduct must shock the conscience. Again, it must be so bad. It's not just wrong, but it's shocking. And there's two ways that you can actually meet that test of what shocks the conscience. One, you can have a special relationship with the impacted party and somehow violate that relationship, pull the rug out from under them. Or two, you, agency, could be the one who created that danger in the first place. Let's take a look at how they applied that. Slide 65. The circuit court asked, was there a special relationship?
I apologize. Yeah, we had a question that came in a little bit late on my end. I apologize.
Yeah.
This came in from about 2 or 3 minutes ago, and they were in reference to when you're talking about search and seizure.
Mm-hmm.
They're asking, what about searching a cell phone?
Yes, it's a very good question. Perhaps a better one for the FBI. I would say that people would have a reasonable expectation of privacy in a cell phone. I gave the example of a laptop computer. And I think that any kind of electronic technology would probably come into the category of effects. It's not a person. It's not a house. You might argue that it's part of your business enterprise, so that it's paper. But it would certainly be entitled to some expectation of privacy. And people do get warrants for wiretaps to search laptops. And I would say that they could probably get a warrant to search a cell phone as well. I'm vaguely aware that you know, there's this concept of warrantless wiretapping, but I'm not aware that EPA has ever entertained any kind of activity like that. I hope that answers the question. We could follow up more if we need. So, if we're ready, we could go back to slide 65. You recall that the Second Circuit was saying, how do you violate substantive due process? Well, you can develop a special relationship with the injured party. In this case, it didn't appear that Christine Todd Whitman personally had a special relationship with the people of Lower Manhattan. She's EPA administrator based in D.C. She doesn't know people by name. But imagine if you're not the EPA administrator, but if you are, in fact, an OSC, which is the focus of our conversation today. Is it possible that an OSC ever develops a special relationship with people that we are charged to protect? In this photo on slide 65 is an OSC, a federal EPA OSC, surrounded by people who were moved into temporary relocation when their community was contaminated by some pretty serious asbestos. And when we realized that we were just unable to clean it all up, we had to move people out in a hurry, and this photo was taken of them in the parking lot of an apartment complex. What if, as an OSC, we told everyone that it was safe to go back to their community and we knew it wasn't? Would people have a reasonable reliance on that OSC's word that it was safe to go back? Just think about whether or not we do form special relationships in any of our OSC work. And if we do, can people rely on it? And if we breach that trust, what are the claims that could be brought? Not commenting on the validity of any claims, but understand that relationships may develop in certain contexts, and people may rely on that. So if Christine Todd Whitman did not develop a personal relationship with people of Lower Manhattan, the other test for substantive due process, did the state create this danger in the first place? Obviously, it was not the state, I don't think, flying airplanes into the Twin Towers. Did the government have any role in putting people there, in keeping people there? In this case, there was no information that Whitman personally had any information on the data of the dust, and that maybe she wasn't deliberately putting people in danger. However, query whether or not someone closer to the scene might have that data, like an OSC. It's possible that a political appointee may not be charged with knowing everything about a site. It might be harder for an OSC who's actually supposed to be on scene to make the same claims that we didn't know. So just understand that people can make these claims of substantive due process, and we may not know what will happen to them. The usual way that people make claims that their due process rights were violated is something called procedural due process, slide 67. And this may be a much more straightforward way to argue due process. Nor shall people be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And in this case, you just look to see what is the process, and did we follow that process or not? You may know that there was a big constitutional challenge raised to our very authority to issue unilateral administrative orders under CERCLA Section 106. If we issue a unilateral order under Section 106, parties may comply with it. They may not comply with it, but one thing they don't have is a right to a hearing first about whether or not that UAO is valid. If people choose not to comply with it, they kind of take their chances and see whether or not the agency will move to enforce. General Electric was afraid that they might someday receive a unilateral order to compel them to clean up the Hudson River. They had not received that order yet. They challenged the very authority under CERCLA 106 as unconstitutional. They said it was a facially unconstitutional denial of due process to not have a right to a hearing before that UAO was issued. That case began in the year 2000, and it was filed by perhaps the leading expert in the nation on constitutional law, Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard. He wrote most casebooks under constitutional law, or taught the people who wrote them now. So you can't dismiss it as a wacky idea that Section 106 is facially unconstitutional. And in fact, that argument did receive lots and lots of judicial review and consideration and attention, and may have been resolved finally 10 years later, last year, by the D.C. Circuit. As the Supreme Court has repeatedly stated, the range of interests protected by procedural due process is not infinite. Issuing an order is not the same thing as making someone comply with it. EPA's authority to issue an order did not take money away from GE, making them pay for the cleanup of the Hudson River. But what GE argued is that the very issuance of an order does affect us as an organization, because it affects our stock price, or it affects our brand name, or it affects our credit rating. Those are things that you are depriving us unless we get a hearing on the UAO. And the court here last year said, well, those kind of things, like stock price and brand value, are not things that the government controls anyway. And if the very authority to issue UAO affects your stock price or brand rating, that's not a property that is protected by the Fifth Amendment. And therefore, EPA can and does issue UAOs. And if EPA moves to enforce that UAO, then we have to go back to court to enforce it. There is your due process at that point, but not when EPA is thinking about writing an order. So, Section 106 of CERCLA is so far not unconstitutional, but it is all about process. It really is. When does someone have the right to challenge an order at one point? And do they have the process? And the court in this case said, yeah, you challenge the process after the order is issued and enforced. An easier way to look at due process is just look at some of the processes that are spelled out in the statute or the regs themselves. If we're going to issue a unilateral administrative order written right into the CFR, the National Contingency Plan, that order shall advise a person, slide 70, that an officer or employee of the agency that issued the order will be available to confer with the respondent prior to the effective date of the order. We issue the order on a Wednesday. We want the order to be effective on a Friday. We need to give some opportunity for that respondent some opportunity to come in and talk with us, to confer with us. prior to the effective date of the order. And if we fail to do that, if we fail to provide that kind of process that's written right into law or regulations, then it might be an easier case to say you failed to meet the test of procedural due process. You deprived me of the process that I was due. So we have these opportunities for comments written right into our procedures. They're there for a reason, and we need to be sure we're following them. And if we're not, we're not just violating the regulations. Someone could say we're violating the Fifth Amendment requirement for due process. So these things can count. Slide 71. We are now approaching the question about taking or destroying this property. When you keep reading the Fifth Amendment, you find that there's a whole bunch of things in there. It's due process, it's self-incrimination, and it concludes with this phrase, "Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Just looking at that, notice that it doesn't say that you can't take private property. There's no prohibition on the government taking your house. You just can't take that private property without just compensation. And we'll talk about what it means to take property and what it means to provide just compensation. Slide 72. There's lots of theories for takings, but they boil down to two broad categories. Something called regulatory takings, something called physical takings. Regulatory takings are things like EPA passes a rule that says you cannot build a house in a coastal zone. And someone says, your rule took my right to build the house in a coastal zone, therefore you've taken my property interest. OSCs don't write rules for the most part. We don't do a lot of regulatory takings in the OSC world. Really, when our guys are in the field, what they're likely to run into most often is an argument about physical takings. And a physical taking can be any kind of physical taking of some property interest. Look at slide 73. Here are some examples. One of the leading cases on physical takings is a case known as Loretto versus Manhattan Teleprompter. A 30-foot cable strung across a rooftop. Cable may be half an inch in diameter, 30 feet long, but you're taking that much space, half an inch diameter, 30 feet long. You're also taking airspace. Yes, a cable can be a takings. A monitoring well, 5 inches wide, 30 feet deep, you are taking that. You put several monitoring wells together, and maybe you're taking the ability for someone to build a house or a casino on it. Hendler versus United States. You are capping a landfill. You're capping it with asphalt. Someone alleges that that landfill would produce methane, and that methane has a market value. And you calculate the market value over that 20 years. Someone can and did allege that we were taking the market value of the methane that that landfill would generate. And a final example, EPA Region 8 is working on a massive emergency response to asbestos contamination in Libby, Montana. EPA wants to remove that asbestos from the front yards and backyards of Libby, Montana, and they want to move it back up to the mine where it came from. That mine is owned by W.R. Grace, and W.R. Grace says, you can't do that. You are taking that space within our mine. And the court, looking at that, says, well, maybe. It may be ironic that Grace is objecting to disposal of asbestos in the mine where it came from, but that can be a physical takings. And the question there would be, well, what is that worth? Let's look at slide 74. This should be familiar now. 3,400 drums. Are we going to be taking these drums? Well, slide 75. Yeah, you bet. We're going to take them. We're going to take them away. That's the job. That's a removal action. That's what OSCs do. We're going to take those drums and we're going to dispose of them properly because whatever they're doing there, they are certainly not properly stored, and it's not a safe situation. So we're going to take those drums. and we're going to dispose of them. You can click to slide 76. Yeah, we took those drums. Slide 77. And the Fifth Amendment doesn't say that we can't take them again. Slide 78. The question is just compensation. Well, what do we owe? The usual response to that is fair market value is just compensation. And the fair market value of 3,000 human drums is negative. In fact, it costs us money to haul and dispose of them properly. So not only do we not owe you money for those drums, you owe us money for the services that we have provided in overpacking and transporting and disposing. And if this concept of taking seems unfamiliar, that's usually because we're not paying them because they should be paying us. Fair market value in many cases of contaminated materials is negative. What about a contaminated structure that we are demolishing? What about a vessel that we have authority to sink? You could ask the same kinds of questions. But if it comes down to a question, slide 79, of whether we must pay, there are three questions that we will address. And there are some times that we actually do take property that has some positive fair market value, or it's a case where we just don't want to argue about what it is, and it moves into a question of if we should pay, how do we pay, who do we pay, and how much do we pay. Let's take a look at that. Slide 79, there is a policy from 1995 that makes it clear that we can use the Superfund Trust Fund to pay compensation for property loss incurred as a result of carrying out the NCP. If you're familiar with the process of writing action memorandums, we can write into an action memorandum. We're going to do things like excavate soil and demolish contaminated structures, and we need to build an access road through this property, and all those things will be authorized. That we can access the Superfund Trust Fund to pay compensation. It could even come down to someone writing a check to cash it out. So yes, the money can come from the Superfund Trust Fund. But slide 80. In general, our policy is that we do not pay PRPs. Not only do we not owe them money, but usually they owe us money. And if they want to argue that we owe them money back, well, then that may be something that we end up just fighting over in a cost recovery case or eventually settling. So we don't generally pay PRPs, but there are some exceptions to it. Imagine a case of a family. Two teenage boys find a bottle of mercury, bring it into the house, spill it, and mercury vapors contaminate the entire structure, and it needs to be demolished. Those boys may be PRPs. They are operators of that bottle of mercury. At the same time, we're probably not going to pursue those boys or their mother who works 12 hours a day and had no knowledge of the mercury bottle. Probably not going to pursue them, even if they might meet the definition of a PRP. And that might be one exception where we need to rebuild their home and compensation might be appropriate. Generally, we're not going to pay mining companies or others if they're liable. They're going to owe us money. Also, we're not going to pay for losses from our own contractors. Our contractors run over someone's prized rose bushes. We're not going to pay for those rose bushes. That's exactly what our contractors have insurance for, and they're required to carry that insurance as part of our contract. So we're probably not going to be paying out losses for property caused by our contractors. Slide 81, if we, the government, have to pay, in general, as I mentioned, what we pay is fair market value. And what does that mean? Well, it's hard to know what the fair market value of a contaminated pair of blue jeans is. Sometimes we do appraisals. Sometimes we have responded to jewelry that we need to throw out. It's contaminated with mercury or arsenic. And before we throw it out, we need to get an appraisal of what a ring is worth that has been contaminated with mercury or arsenic before we throw it out so that we know what we might be liable for compensating, if anything. Slide 82 is interesting. There's not a lot of recent guidance on compensation, but this is maybe the most recent guidance. It comes from a guidance on temporary relocations, 2002. In most situations, slide 82, EPA should provide replacement value for essential furniture items. And there's actually a list of essential furniture items. And appreciated value for non-essential personal property. What this means, if we're throwing away a bed, we replace it with a bed. Attachment 8 is a list of essential furniture items. In America, every family is entitled to one television, and it's not necessarily a 42-inch flat screen. Every person is entitled to one bed. So there may be some things that our Superfund contractors have authority, and check your contracts, to just go out and purchase. And we have done that. And then the contractors identify those purchases in, you know, our own invoices, and we pay them later. If it's not an essential item, then we might actually get an appraisal to identify the depreciated value of personal property. And we probably wouldn't even go here for certain forms of personal property. What is the value of contaminated baseball cards? Well, we're not an insurance company. We're probably not going to be providing any compensation for baseball cards. That was a real issue we faced. But what if we're throwing out someone's entire wardrobe, which we've done? Vapors, you know, permeate the entire facility, and now we're throwing out all your clothes. I mean, imagine if this is you. We might have the depreciated value of something like that, or a car. We need to destroy the car. What is the depreciated value of that 1979 Corolla? We have run into those situations as well. So slide 83 really shows there is a hierarchy of how we deal with just compensation. If we have to do it, our first response is not usually to pay cash. It's to restore it if we can. Clean it up. I think question from Edison is, if we can restore the structure or something, drive away the fumes, that's probably the best way to go. If we can't do that, then maybe we replace it. Maybe we go and buy another 1979 Corolla. We have authority to do that. And the final response is that we can actually provide reimbursement for that too. And sometimes we have ended up just writing a check and getting a settlement and calling it good. Any questions about just compensation at this time? Because I'd heard, or I hope that answered the question before, but I will pause and catch a breath at this moment. Okay. Let's move on. I think we're going on to the last amendment for discussion in the Bill of Rights. The Eighth Amendment, slide 84. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. I'd like to see a show of hands of all the OSCs and friends who have indeed inflicted cruel and unusual punishment as a part of their employment. I'm not seeing any hands raised yet. But understand that people do, on occasion, make arguments that we are indeed inflicting cruel and unusual punishment on people. CERCLA is, after all, a strict liability statute, and many people won't understand that. They may see the threat of treble damages as excessive fines, whether or not we've actually imposed them. They may make all kinds of arguments based on the Eighth Amendment about how the Superfund liability scheme works. I can't say that I've seen any of those arguments prevail, but let's see. They might come up in a context like this, slide 85. Let's just imagine in April of this year, you are seeking access to a piece of property that you know to be contaminated, and you want to go in and clean it up. And when you have sent over your consent for access form, you get this response via email at 8:52 in the evening. Mr. So-and-so, OSC, I will be happy to give up all my civil, and especially my Eighth Amendment rights, via your property rights waiver. Kindly bring it by tomorrow, preferably around 4 p.m. So, do you think this person is really happily giving up her civil rights and happily submitting to Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment? That's rhetorical. If this was a response that you received to seeking access by consent, this is the antithesis of consent. You might say that this is indication that she feels she's being subject to coercion, and even if she signed that access for consent, it might not be the kind of thing that you want to rely on. We never got any more articulation about how she thought we were violating her Eighth Amendment rights. But this was not the kind of case where we could explore that indefinitely. We indeed pursued and obtained a warrant for entry and not risking any further offense to anyone's civil rights. But people make these arguments, and you will see them, and now you know that maybe they feel like they're being submitted, subject to cruel and unusual punishment. Slide 86. If any of this is troubling yet, hopefully I can help give some idea of how to avoid some of these issues. Slide 87, as you've heard me say already, and I will continue to say and leave this, for any of these issues that may come up on any sites where you are involved, you really need to consult your own legal counsel. If you are an EPA person, you should have a lawyer available, not only cheap, but essentially free. I am available to my OSCs in Region 10, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I don't get paid overtime, and they have my cell phone number, and they use it. You should definitely seek out your regional counsel. If you are in a region, you should know who your attorney is for emergency response purposes. If you don't, send me an email, and I could tell you who that is. If you are in a state or other organization, you should have access to someone in the state AG's office or someone else. You should get a real opinion. Even if it requires a time critical response, I really do get questions 24 hours a day, and I'm pretty good about answering them too, so don't be shy about calling when you need help. What else can you do? Slide 88, as any lawyer would tell you, and you probably know already, get it in writing. If you have an agreement for access, someone says, come on my property, I sure I don't mind if you tromp on my rights, you need to get the agreement in writing, or it may not be worth much at all. Get an agreement in writing for access, get an agreement, of course, if they agree to do the cleanup. If you're thinking about property compensation and resolving just compensation issues, there are agreements, there are forms to sign where you could pay $500, for example, and they will waive any further claims, and maybe that's a very efficient way to wrap up some compensation issue. Anything important, you're probably going to need it in writing and make sure that it's coordinated through your attorney. What else can you do? Slide 89. Well, if it's a question of obtaining access to the property, the Fourth Amendment tells you precisely what to do. If you can't get it by consent, you can seek a warrant. And it's just that straightforward. I'm actually working on one right now, this morning, and there are forms for warrant applications, and there are assistant U.S. attorneys and across the country that know how to approach federal magistrates for federal warrants. That you should get to know the people who can help you with that. Finally, slide 90, whatever you do, be real and most particularly reasonable. My usual and concluding advice to any OSC is you don't have to be right, just reasonable. Courts give a lot of deference to people who are out in the field doing very difficult work, operating inherently under limited information. If it turns out that demolishing the structure was not the best course of action in hindsight, if you had a reasonable reason to do it at the time, you'll usually be protected for that. But just be reasonable. Just think about how you would explain this to someone else, why you're doing what you do, and do that. And if it turns out that you guessed and guessed wrong later on, we're usually going to be okay. So, that brings us to slide 91, which is my last one. Again, I would invite questions, and I would wish you well. We have done very well as EPA Region 10, and I think as an agency, in addressing constitutional issues where they have arisen. But we need to be sensitive because they're out there every single day, every time we step on someone's property. These are rights that we need to respect because they're our rights as well. So I'm going to stop talking, invite any more questions, or simply ask Jean to wrap it up.
Okay. I have a couple of questions that are sort of outstanding in our online queue, but before I turn to those, I wanted to invite those of you on the phone lines. If you have a question, you're welcome to come off of mute. If you've muted your line with our commands, it's #6 to unmute. Or you can simply use your own mute button if that's how you've silenced your line to unmute. We'll just ask that you identify yourself and organization and feel free to ask a question or make a comment. And if we don't hear anything there, I apologize for the background noise. I do have a question that came in again. This was an EPA question, and it was in reference to actually searching properties and mm-hmm. going in to respond on a property. How do OSCs deal with homeless individuals? Exactly what are the legal requirements for individuals you find on a property but aren't property owners?
Right. I think I did mention quickly that even homeless individuals who are trespassing or squatting on a property have rights under the Fourth Amendment. Certainly you can't search their person. But also there is a broad interpretation of what it means to be a house, which can include a tent and it can include a van. And so if we intend to go inside that tent or that van or that other place where a homeless person may live, it does give rise to some expectation of privacy. We certainly should barge in. People even have rights. If you are a homeless person and you're being relocated, and we've done that, we've done it in Region 2 among others, people have rights to even be relocated, even if you were a homeless person under the Uniform Relocation Act. It kind of spells out a procedure for moving a homeless person into an apartment. You don't make a homeless person homeless again. But you try to find some better situation for them. So the Uniform Relocation Act applies even to homeless individuals. But if it's not a question of relocation, but just going on to the area, something that may be called the curtilage, the immediate area surrounding the tent, the van, you should approach that with some level of respect and deference and ask. If they deny you access to go and look for contaminated soil underneath the van or whatever, go talk to your attorney again, see what your rights are. But don't assume that just because it's a homeless person that they have no rights. They certainly do.
Okay, great. We have another question also coming in from an EPA office. And their question is in reference to a warrant. They stated that when I had a warrant, I couldn't deviate from the action items stated on the warrant. And then a declaration was required with the return of the federal warrant. And they wanted mm-hmm. to know why that declaration was required.
Yeah, that's a very good question. We've done a presentation that is just all about warrants, and that could take a number of hours in itself. But the Fourth Amendment, going right back to the very language, when it talks about particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, you know, we're not making that up as a Congress or an agency. The framers of the Constitution wrote those words. And when we particularly describe that place to be searched and person or things to be seized, then we need to comply with it. And if we don't describe that blue building or the dwelling 8 by 12 feet, then we may not have access to it. And the courts have a check on that. And they want to be sure that not only when they issue a warrant that it was done properly, but that we complied with the warrant. And so usually there is a step after the warrant has been served, after you have done the entry, then you go back to that same federal magistrate and you explain how you did, what you did, consistent with the warrant. And among other things, if you're looking for, you know, why we do that, well, it assures the magistrate that we are trustworthy, that he can sign a warrant and that we are able to carry it out, and we do that, and that we have not taken any liberties. Warrants is kind of an extraordinary remedy because they are what's known as an ex parte hearing. It's just the agency and the magistrate. It's not agency with notice to the liable party, and then that person has a right to appear before the same magistrate. It's really the magistrate kind of trusting the agency that we're going in there for a lawful purpose, and we're going to do what the warrant says. And part of maintaining that trust is that when we're done serving the warrant, we go back to that same magistrate and explain, yes, in fact, we complied with the terms of the warrant, and we retain that level of trust.
Okay, great. Again, one last check to see if any of our participants on the phone lines have any questions. And I don't see any other online questions that have been submitted, So with that, before we close things out, again, Cliff, I wanted to give you an opportunity to make any sort of closing statements to the audience, if you'd like.
Okay. Well, thank you all for those who stuck on the phone. It may not be an easy thing to explain to the colleagues about how you sat through a lecture on constitutional law for 2 hours on the phone. I really appreciate the attention, and I commend all of you for realizing that constitutional issues are pretty serious, and they come up in our real world all the time. And it's been profoundly gratifying that we've had a lot of interest in the live OSC readiness presentations in the past, and it's great to have this opportunity to reach a broader audience as well. Again, I have not tried to answer any specific constitutional law questions, but I hope I've given you some sense about what issues are out there that may arise and how people may go about addressing those questions on their own. So I hope this has been useful. I am available phone at the phone number there, and if for EPA people can also reach me on the EPA email address as well. So thank you for your attention.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. With that, I'm going to move everyone along to slide number 92, which is the final slide in the material that we're prepared for today. And on slide number 2, you're going to find 2 very important links. The first one is an additional resources page where you'll be able to download today's PowerPoint presentation material, as well as look at other items that are related to the topic and part of the OSC Readiness Training Presents series. The other link that you'll find on slide number 92 is a link to our short feedback form. It does take just a minute or two to fill it out and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you are looking to participate in future free online training through Clue-In, we would encourage you to take just a minute to fill out that form, because I do read each and every response, and it is how we guarantee to offer future deliveries and continue to improve the seminars that we host on Clue-In. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation today as part of a record-keeping process, for example, for CEUs or PDHs, again, we don't necessarily offer CEUs or PDHs ourselves through Clue-In. However, you did receive a registration confirmation when you signed up. You have access to the slides to download. You got a description as well as contact information for myself and the instructor from the seminar homepage. And if you take a minute to fill out the feedback form, there's actually a box you can check to have a confirmation sent to you by email for your own records. You may have luck earning credit from your affiliated association or institution for CEUs or training requirements with that information. If you shared the line with multiple participants, again, as each person fills out the feedback form, once you submit your answer, there'll be a link to allow the next person to hop on the computer and fill out their own version of the feedback form and also get their own confirmation message. If you are not sitting at a computer with internet right now and instead printed out the materials, both of those links are available at the seminar homepage, and that will continue to remain active after today's session. So you can certainly come back to it later on in the week if you prefer and get a copy of the slides and fill out your feedback at that time. So with that, I wanted to thank everybody for participating. I wanted to thank our presenters and organizers for putting together today's session. I also wanted to thank the over 37 people from across the country that participated today, both via phones as well as streaming simulcast. I hope that you found today's session to be a useful expenditure of your time, and that we'll continue to have you join us on future Clue-In Internet seminars. With that, again, I thank everyone. Hope you have a great rest of your day, whether it's morning or afternoon in your time zone. And that will be the official conclusion for today's session. Thanks so very much. Take care.